Hi, Bomb Squad. Welcome to Food for Thought, a Radio Cherry Bomb miniseries. I'm Carrie Diamond, editor-in-chief of Cherry Bomb magazine. We wanted to know what's on your mind, so we hit the road and went on tour to eat, drink, and talk with lots of you all across the country. Today's stop is San Diego, California, where we heard from six women changing the local food scene. Thank you to Kerrygold for supporting our Food for Thought tour. Kerrygold is the Irish brand known for its award-winning butter and cheese, made with milk from grass-fed cows from family farms all over Ireland. We'll be hearing more about their amazing product later, so stay tuned. First up, let's listen to a short talk from Laura Johnson of You and Yours Distilling Company.
Thank you so much. I'm going to kind of dive into how I became a distiller and how I came to run a distillery at 23, 24. So originally, I'm from the Dallas area, born and raised, grew up with pretty relaxed parents. There's not a lot to do in that part of Texas other than go to sporting events and get in trouble. And I did plenty of both. So I was kind of always encouraged. Alcohol was never like a taboo in our family. I was always encouraged to like try a sip of my parents' wine or you know, just try a taste of their cocktail. So I feel like I grew up with quite a healthy, respectful relationship to alcoholic beverages from an early age. And then my love for distilling kind of first clicked the summer after I graduated from high school. So I went on this kind of fun, what I understand now was like a nice father-daughter bonding trip before I went off to college. So we ended up going on this fun trip together before I moved out here to San Diego to go to USD. And on that trip, we just happened to pop into a distillery tour. And I just remember being fascinated, like completely enthralled. I couldn't believe how similar the process was to cooking. I just remember my dad is super ADD, and we were like 20 minutes into the tour, and he was like, okay, come on, Laura, you ready to go? Next thing? And I was like, absolutely not. We're staying put. And I, like I said, I just couldn't believe how similar it was to cooking or creating flavors. There's all these different opportunities along the distillation and the fermentation process where you can really put your mark on the spirit and make it your own. All growing up, I remember like being in middle school and, you know, pretending to be sick so I could stay home from school and watch the Food Network. Like those were my idols. Like I just worshipped like Emeril and Ina and Jada. And so the fact that there was this whole other process, like I used to stay up late just so I could watch like the original like Iron Chef. But I couldn't believe that there was this whole process behind these spirits that I knew nothing about. And so, yeah, I kind of had that as a bug in my mind, moved out here to do my undergrad, continued to hone my love of drinking throughout my college years, as one does. And I studied international business and economics, and I come from, you know, quite entrepreneurial blood, I suppose. And so I always knew that I wanted to have my own company of some sort at some point in my life, but really didn't know what that was going to be. But I knew that, again, I had this interest in wine and spirits. And so as soon as I turned 21, I signed up for the WSET. So kind of thought maybe going down like a wine track or sommelier track would be, you know, like a first step. I didn't really know where to start. I started a blog, Distillerista, and started sharing cocktail recipes. But again, I just kind of, I had no idea where this was going to take me, but I knew that I had the interest and the passion. Like, I maybe passed high school chemistry, I'm not sure. But just the ability to kind of impart flavors on a spirit was what really hooked me. So fast forward again, I graduate from University of San Diego. Again, kind of like, what do I do now, right? As I think happens to a lot of us. But I found a distilling course online. So it was kind of like this one-on-one, like intensive master distillers course at a distillery up in Washington State. And so I literally walked across the stage, got my diploma. The next day I was on a plane to go do this distilling course. I just remember being at this course and it was two older gentlemen who had, this was kind of like their second career. They'd opened a distillery and quickly found that they could charge a lot of money to teach other people how to open a distillery. And I was like fresh out of college. I do not think that they thought that this was what they were going to get that week. And I basically got like a pat on the head, like, oh, cute, you want to be a distiller? Great. And so it was a little bit of a disheartening experience. It was an interesting week, to say the least. But ultimately, I left after the course just thinking to myself, like, if these knuckleheads, and I used a different word, more colorful word, but if these guys can do this, and they had a substantial amount of regional market share and still do to this day, and if they can be, you know, marginally successful, I can absolutely crush this. This is what we're doing. Like, this is where we're going. And so that I was a dog on a bone after that. I basically spent the next 9-10 months after graduation just traveling all over the states, doing any distilling workshop, masterclass, apprenticeship, anything I could find online and get my hands on, just kind of like made my way around. There are a few programs nowadays, but back then, this was only about, I would say, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but there wasn't any type of formal distilling education, so I just kind of like did what I could. Came back to San Diego, really wanted a distilling position. I wanted more time on a still. I felt like I had a lot of industry knowledge, a lot of passion, but not necessarily a lot of like hands-on practical experience. So I reached out to every distillery in Southern California, California that I could find at the time, which, you know, weren't very many. And, you know, like maybe 2 people got back to me. And so it was very hard to find at the time a distillery that was like, A, you know, well enough established to have an open position of that kind, but B, be willing to kind of, you know, take a chance on me for that position, because I definitely don't think like this is what you think of when you think of a distiller, right? So again, kind of another interesting stepping stone in my journey. I was kind of like, okay, well, what do I do now? And so I took a step back and I was like, you know, what do I know how to do? I studied international business. I'd already started writing the business plan for what would eventually become You and Yours. I felt like I had created enough contacts and relationships throughout my travels and education that I could go to for capital. And I just said, hell with it, I'm gonna do this myself. And so I did. So after I circulated the business plan, I had my desired raise verbally committed in about a month. Keyword, verbally committed. It was definitely an interesting process getting my project fully funded. But that is kind of the somewhat abridged version of how You and Yours came to be. So it took about 2.5 years from finishing the business plan to actually opening the doors at You and Yours, but we did March 2017, as I mentioned, and it's been a total whirlwind. It feels like, you know, 2 months and like 20 years all at the same time, but I wouldn't rather be doing anything else. This is what I've worked so hard for, and I feel like the whole time I was just met, you know, as we often are when starting something new that isn't really done very often, you know, like a random chick opening a distillery, like, what are you trying to do? But the whole time I was just so convicted. Like, I knew I had something to bring to the table. I knew that, oh, like, during my travels and visiting all these distilleries and learning from these other people, I saw this huge gap in the market for a distilling concept that put an equal amount of thought and effort not only into the quality of the product and, you know, the ingredients that they're using, but also the quality of the experience as a whole. And I think, obviously, my love of food and hospitality helped me in you know, creating delicious spirits, I hope, but also in just knowing, understanding how to create an incredible experience as well. And so if you've ever been to You and Yours, if you've been to the tasting room, hopefully that comes through. You know, you walk in and we just want you to feel immediately at ease. I don't care what you know or what you don't know about gin or distilling or the origin story of, you know, the old-fashioned cocktail or what have you. I just want you to come in and have a good time and hopefully you learn a little something. But I think at the end of the day, I think we're all just in the business of making people happy and sharing what makes us happy. So hopefully I'm doing an okay job of it. Yeah.
Thank you, Laura. We loved hearing about your journey. Next, we'll hear from Diane Rocha about one of the Bomb Squad's favorite subjects, Julia Child.
Yes, I taught English and history in Vista, California for 22 years. Damn near killed me. But this young woman right here, Emily Myers, who came down here with me, was my student 15 years ago. And I was a big grammar teacher, because I went to Catholic school, right? So we're doing this grammar exercise, and it said, Julia Child, the French chef, and whatever else the sentence said. And so I said to the students, this is what, 2004-ish? And I said, so Julia Child, you all know who Julia Child is. And I got, it was seventh grade, I got these blank looks. And I said, let me tell you about Julia Child. Told them the whole story about who she was and the French chef and how she was 50 years old when she first started. And I was 40 when I was became a teacher. And so this, that, and the other. And then I told them the story about how in 1989, I was a stay-at-home mom. I had my two kids, Kate and Matthew, who were six and two. And Julia Child came to town, to La Jolla, to Warwick's Books, for her book signing of The Way to Cook, her last book that she wrote on her own. And I said, I have to go see her. I have to meet her. I just have to do this. In the meantime, as this stay-at-home mom, I was getting bored. So I started making English muffins. And do you all, I don't know if you're local, but you know the Panikin? Okay, so I sold English muffins to the Panikin because the guy who used to own the Panikin rode motorcycles with my then husband. And one day he came over for what they called the Norton Prince of Darkness motorcycle ride and chili cook-off. You can tell which part I was in that. And I said, hey, Bob, you want to try some English muffins? And he said, he had one with my homemade strawberry jam on it. And he said, these are great. And I said, good, do you want to buy some? Because I need to do something out of the home and make some money. And he said, yeah, yeah. So two gross a week from my little kitchen when I was living over by San Diego State. It was hilarious. So this is when I was still doing that. So I got the babysitter for the baby, Matthew, because he was two. He would never have known the difference. And I took Kate with me. Now, Kate was six, and so she'd been watching, well, they were videotapes at that point. Julia did something. Might have been called The Way to Cook. She did a series of videotapes, and Kate and I would watch them. And Kate's birthday cake every year was the classical Genoise with the whipped cream and the strawberries on it. And so I took Kate with me. We drove to La Jolla. We walked in. No, Julia. By the way, I made her a dozen English muffins, packed them up in a box, wrote her a letter. Dear Julia, you are the one who taught me how to cook. My mother thought she did, but she didn't. You're the one who really did. With your show, Julia Child and Company, and Julia Child and More Company, I've learned everything I've known from you. So there she is. She walks in, and Kate's going, Mom. And I said, I know, she's here. So we get in the line, and we're waiting in the line. And they always have the helpers with them when they're big like that. I don't mean in stature, I mean, you know. And so the lady, and I said, here's this box. It's got English muffins in it. I made them for I have this little business. So it's my turn. She hands the box to Julia. I swear to God, she really did this. I was looking in her eyes, and she was sitting down, because she really was 6'2". She's banging on the box. Oh, goody, goody gumdrops, homemade English muffins. She really did say that. It was so funny. And I said, yes, and I told her that I was making them, well, I guess professionally. I was getting paid for it, so I guess that makes it a profession, right? And she said, she got very serious. I'm so glad you're doing this. We need more cottage industry like this. Oh my God. She said, English muffins. She said to me, how do you get them to cook so that they're cooked all the way through and not burn on the outside? And I'm going, Julia Child is asking me how to do this? And then I remembered her recipe didn't work. This was not her recipe. This was from a jam book called Jams Chez Madeleine or something like that. And I said, oh, yeah, that is the secret, isn't it? And I told her how I did it, and it was all about rolling it around in a bowl of cornmeal. And I said, like you had taught me on one of your shows about cornmeal being like a ball bearing. And she said, I never really thought about that. And it was unbelievable. I couldn't believe it. So we're in the store, and she signs the book, and she didn't sign much of anything, you know, good luck or whatever. And then Kate and I are lurking around the store watching her some more. And you should have seen Kate. I have to tell you, you know how moms are, right? So this kid of mine is 6 years old, and she's just standing there looking at her. And Julia said some things to her. I can't remember what it was, but it was really cute. So, okay, fast forward. It's 2010. I'm on what I called my odyssey, because I decided, being a teacher, I needed to take some time off during the summer and actually do something and not stand at the Xerox machine getting ready for the next school year. Remember all those grammar packets? Remember those? And so I took off. I went on this odyssey. I went up to Portland just to go to Powell's Books, because I needed more cookbooks, right, to add to that 4,000 collection. And so I'm coming back. It was 2010, so I'm in my little Volkswagen Cabrio with the top down, Bonnie Raitt blasting, having a great time, and the car dies on the side of the road. I got two tires off the road. That was it. And I'm talking about I was 4 miles north of Point Arena, which is 250 miles north of San Francisco, on the one, not the 101, the one that goes like this, and you can only drive 25 miles an hour, thankfully. So I've got my two tires off on the side of the road, and some guy comes, turns around, takes his truck, and pushes me the rest of the way off the road, and I was a little nervous about that. Called whoever, the tow truck comes. I'm taking pictures of the tow truck taking my car away. They take me down to Point Arena. I was on my way to that lighthouse, because I also like lighthouses. And now I'm stuck there for a week because, I don't know if I can say this, but what is the industry in Humboldt County?
Marijuana.
Growing pot, exactly. So the town of Point Arena is about 5 blocks long. The entire town is stoned. It looks like you can see smoke through the whole thing. So he kept my car for a week, never fixed it. Charged me $1,000, never fixed it. He had it towed to Healdsburg, where his brother fixed it for another $1,000. That's another story. Anyway, so I put it up on Facebook, the picture of my car being towed, and one of my friends called, and he said, I love Point Arena. You have to go meet the jam lady. I said, okay, I'll meet the jam lady. So I walk a mile down the road, because I don't have a car, and I turn right, and there's a sign, the jam lady. Her real name is Lisa Joachimides. She calls herself the jam lady. She makes jam in Point Arena, sends it all over the place. I went in. She has a full, a kitchen like that one, all stainless steel, really professional and all that. We start talking, blah, blah, blah. She says, yeah, I used to work for Barbara Trop at Chinaman Cafe. And I said, oh, my God, I love her. We figured out she cooked my dinner sometime before. I was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. She says, and I told her the Julia Child story. Oh, I forgot to tell you part of it. She wrote me a letter. She answered my little note that I had scrawled on a little, tiny legal piece of paper. She wrote me a letter. Julia Child wrote me a letter. I have evidence. And so I wrote back to her. She wrote me again. I still owe her a letter. I don't know why I never finished that. So I'm telling this story to Lisa, the jam lady. She says, wait right here. Thinking, okay, what's going on here? I'm in this really weird place. She disappears upstairs, comes down with a box, opens the box. She has a dozen flutes, champagne flutes, from Julia's 90th birthday party. She says, you need these. She gave me two of them. Isn't that amazing? I just went, I'm a total stranger. And she said, we're not strangers. She said, you have to have these. They have to be yours. And so I said, okay. Thank you. We wrapped them very carefully. They got home, even through the bumpy Healdsburg thing. And so then, on her 100th birthday, and I'm not sure what, I think that was, I don't remember what year it was. On her 100th birthday, I was home from school that day. I think it was in August, so I was home legally. And I cooked everything, just all Julia Child stuff. And I called one of my friends. I said, come on over. We used the Julia Child flutes. We had a little split of champagne. We toasted her. I put it all up on Facebook. It was amazing. And now, oh, it's so funny, I have those glasses. They're in my glass cabinet, but they're hidden in the back. And my son-in-law was here in February, and he went to reach for that to put for his champagne. I said, oh, no, no. Look what that says on it. He says, Julia Child's 90th birthday. I said, you don't use those. You don't appreciate that. This is Julia Child. I mean, come on. So that is my Julia Child story. I love her, love her. The day that she died, my daughter was about 20, I think. She called me. She was living on her own. She called me. She says, Mom, I have really bad news. I thought, uh-oh, what is this? Were you in an accident? She says, Julia died today. And it was as if her grandmother and my mother had died. You know, we were so sad. We cried on the phone. And, who's better than Julia Child, right? Well, now we have Ina, but Julia Child. In my heart.
Thank you, Diane, for sharing your story and for bringing me some of those English muffins. English muffin pizzas were one of my favorite things to eat as a kid, so I made a lot of them over the past few months, thanks to you. Our final talk comes from Monica Maccioni. Monica shares the story behind her very unique career pivot.
Thank you.
Okay. First of all, thank you very much for inviting me and for giving me the opportunity to share my personal path through food, and especially through, I am a gelato chef, so a world full of passion and flavor I am very happy to be part of since 2014, when we decided to open this gelato place, and my life changed completely. So I was born in Sardinia. Sardinia is an island in the center of the Mediterranean Sea. As an Italian girl, I used to cook with my mom, my grandmother, and my grandfather was a farmer. So we had a lot of fresh and local produce to cook. And so this is my background in cooking. But when I decided what to do with my life, I decided to study electronic engineering. So I have been an electronic engineer for a couple of years as and a consultant. Then I decided to have a master in lighting design. So, and this completely changed my approach to my job, because lighting is a kind of art, a creativity. When you make a lighting project, you create something that is completely different from what you expect, because otherwise it's dark at night. So you create different scenarios, and with your creativity, you can make different choices. And that is my approach now with food and with gelato. So I worked as a lighting designer for 20 years, almost 20 years, and the cooking was a passion for me. I love to cook. I loved especially to do marmalade and jams that is similar to gelato, because you mix a lot of ingredients. You can mix fruit, nuts, spices, and the flavor is always different. And I like also to study, so I had some courses with a friend of mine that is a one-star chef, one-star Michelin chef. But it was a hobby, a passion. I liked to give as a gift this marmalade to friends. I worked in a big company, and my husband too, but our dream was to make something different, something by ourselves, to make something that give happiness. One day he came home, it was like 2012, and he told me, why we don't quit our job and we open a gelato place? I said, what? And he said, now or never, we are not too young. And I said, you are okay, so... So we decided to quit our job, and we had a lot of courses with the gelato maestro, Gianpaolo Valli, is a guru in the gelato world, and we learned all the techniques to make gelato. And then we decided to open in the States. We moved to first to New York, and then we ended up here. And we found the perfect spot in La Jolla. The landlord was renting the day we arrived at the spot we rented. So it was something, a good karma for us. And in 2014, we opened our first location. Our idea of gelato, the way we make gelato, is really connected with Italy. But we found so many things here in California, our new home. It's full of produce you can use, nuts. So it's a very inspiring place to open a gelato shop. And my idea of gelato is a simple food, because my roots are in Sardinia. Sardinia is an island that has been conquered by everybody in the Mediterranean Sea. So we have influences from North Africa, Eastern Europe. But we were a poor place, so our food is very simple, but you can taste everything you eat. So our gelato is something, a simple food, but made in a traditional way with a slow process combined with ingenuity, because I like to combine different flavors. And here you can find everything. When you go around, everything you eat, you drink, you smell, can be an inspiration for a gelato. So here, for me, is the correct place to mix my roots with a new world. And this is my new path of my new life. coming back to my dream was to open this place that gives happiness. In Italy, we say, poco poco, man, non mangia sempre un dolce, prendi sempre un gelato. It means have a little scoop, not a big one, but don't give up in gelato, with gelato. So what I say is gelato make you happy. Very good gelato make you even happier. So thank you for inviting me. This is my story.
Thank you, Monica. We stopped by Baboy for some gelato during our visit, and I had a scoop of stracciatella and a scoop of pistachio in a cone, of course. Don't forget, I'm a big proponent of cone only, so you don't have to throw a cup and spoon in the garbage. Before we get to our panel, let's hear a word about Kerrygold. Hi, everybody. It's Carrie Diamond here to talk to you about Kerrygold cheese and butter. I traveled to Ireland this summer to learn more about Kerrygold, the family-run dairy farms they work with, and the beautiful cheese and butter made from their grass-fed dairy. I hung out with cows for the first time in my life. I visited a picturesque cliffside farm in the southeast of Ireland overlooking the ocean. I walked on a lot of grass. I ate a lot of scones slathered with Kerrygold butter, which is truly the color of sunshine. I learned how Kerrygold tests and grades its famous cheeses, from its award-winning reserve cheddar cheese to its nutty and robust Dubliner cheese. I also stopped by Beechmount Farm to learn how they make my favorite, Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish Farmhouse Cheese. You should definitely plan a visit to Ireland to get a taste of this beautiful country. Or you can just visit your favorite grocery store. For more on Kerrygold, visit KerrygoldUSA.com. Let's welcome Chef Claudette Zepeda, farmer Mai Nguyen, and Crystal White of Wayfarer Bread. To kick things off, I ask the panel to describe themselves in one word. First up is Claudette.
Mother. That's it. I think that's the epitome of the word, all the good and bad connotations that come along with mothering. It's part of my job. It's part of my identity. As a chef, it's been the easiest tool that I can find. I mean, who wants to disappoint their moms? No one. Not one person wants to hear their mom says, oh man, I'm disappointed. If you get, your mom gets angry, and you know she's gonna get over it. When she's disappointed, that carries way more weight. And I learned as a chef and as a mother, I shifted being angry at things with like, dang it, I thought I would have taught them better as my cooks too, because that's something that I do with my children. And my daughter and my son have very different personalities. I parent them completely different, and that's how I feel I am in the kitchen. Every cook has a different personality, a different set of rules and guidelines and what drives them. So I am a mother at home, and I'm a mother in the kitchen.
Crystal?
I'm a baker. I've always wanted to be one. I've always been one. Even when I'm dealing with everything besides baking, the only reason I opened a bakery is because I love to bake. And it's the only thing that keeps me grounded.
Even when you were little, you knew you wanted to be a baker?
Yeah, I've been telling people I wanted to open a bakery by the beach since I was 10 years old. My parents think it's hilarious that I actually went through with it.
That's amazing. Yeah. Mai, what's your one word?
I'd say my one word, catalyst. I start a lot of things, and I like sparking ideas and projects and working with people to really get things going.
That's great. Catalyst. I love that. What food-related topic is on your mind these days, since this is the Food for Thought tour?
The irony that vegetarians and vegans don't want to pay for a vegetarian or vegan meal made with organic vegetables at a restaurant. That's my biggest complaint, where a vegan will complain about a $24 entree. I'm like, we literally are walking outside and pulling it out of the dirt for you, but you'll pay $3 at Whole Foods for that same exact vegetable. One. I just find it ironic a little bit. So that's a lot on my mind right now of, like, how do you get people to value it? How do you do it eloquently without going, you should pay for, you know, without getting angry about it and just being like, how do I make this a more graceful conversation?
How do you? Do you have some thoughts on how to do that?
I have my cooks. We have this thing called a chef swim. So we let the servers, you know, kind of give it a if you sell it right and you can make anything sound romantic, people will kind of be like, oh yes, that sounds good. If you're a good, you know, salesperson or generally customer service oriented server. And then the cooks go out and describe what it is. Versus, because the chef's whim, the server won't know what's going to happen on the plate until we kind of play a Russian roulette on the line. And I say, chef's whim, and whoever raises their hands or whoever doesn't raise their hand then gets picked. And they create the dish out of nothing. And if there's three vegetarians or three vegans at a table, they all get something different. So then the cooks walk out and have to interact with the customers. And then it's the customer, then it adds value to it because they have some trained professional make something for them. They explain which box it came out of, what grows around it, the pollinators that help, you know, and we really put a lot of effort into this garden, and you can see it's on steroids right now with the bees and the summer, just kind of one switch happened and then the corn grew taller than the lights now. But I think that the connection between putting a human in front of them that had to do it. Because if I took avocados off the menu when they got really expensive, because then I couldn't justify charging someone $30 for a, you know, guacamole plate. But they'll go, oh, there's avocados at Costco. Yeah, well, they're bad avocados. Like, you don't want avocados from Peru, I promise. You want avocados as close to you as you can. But they don't put a human next to a vegetable. We don't, because we're a consumer generation of, like, it's supposed to be instant. Amazon Prime brought it in an hour. You know, it's like, we're humans and we grow things, and here we grow things and we sow them. So it's the connection, it comes full circle.
All right, Crystal, what is on your mind?
There's this massive shift happening with our culture. You know, people are buying a lot of things online now. Retail stores are closing. A lot more like online community is happening, but it's shifting the way that community is formed. And I think that, you know, like bakeries and coffee shops are one of the last remaining traditional places where community is built. Like, the same people come in every single day and they talk to their neighbors and they're actually like experiencing that community that I feel like most of the people in this room grew up with, because we're kind of pre-digital age. I don't know, I spent a lot of time thinking about what kind of, that's a lot of pressure on some terms, because it's like people aren't, they're kind of losing their social skills. I know I am, like, I'm really bad at talking to people because I stare at my phone all the time. And like, I feel like being like kind of one of the last like strongholds of a traditional community sense, I'm kind of just always thinking about what role that plays for the future and how things are gonna change in the future and what place bakeries and coffee shops have in that general grand scheme of things. It's like very wholesome, but it's also like kind of terrifying.
Like, to... Well, Crystal, your social skills seem just fine.
Okay, thanks.
Just to reassure you.
My daughter likes to call me an elder millennial. Yeah. We still have a little bit of social skills.
Yeah.
My.
Yeah, so what am I thinking about most these days other than this baby?
Sleep. That answer's okay.
Yeah. But and a lot of these times where, you know, I'm sitting and nursing and thinking about this world that I've brought this baby into, I'm just like, I'm sorry, we didn't solve climate change, we didn't solve structural racism before you were born. And I guess between the two, the one that I end up thinking about the most, especially in regard to farming and my ability to make a living farming, kind of going back to what Claudette is talking about, structural racism is so tied to that. We devalue food because we've devalued the people who've grown food since the founding of this country, and we continue to do that. And as I think about the other big one, climate change, right, and thinking about alternatives to how we're, you know, conducting our industries and farming and transforming our landscapes, the alternative practices are ones that we already have. They're with immigrant communities, indigenous communities, and that structural racism has largely maligned and marginalized those forms of knowledge that are really key to having different ways of growing food and valuing it and valuing each other and having community around it. If I had to choose one. Yeah, structural racism.
So you've got a lot on your mind. But it is interesting, the parallels between what Claudette said and what you're talking about. The value of human, the value of a vegetable. Yeah, how they're connected. So one thing I would love to talk to you about is the San Diego scene. I'm new to the San Diego scene. So tell us a little bit about what you love about San Diego. Claudette, we'll start with you.
You know, I make Mexican food, so the proximity to the border is both amazing for me because I can cross the border, go get ingredients, and come right back, but it's also kind of my Achilles heel because I have to convince people that what I charge is value. Again, going into what we value as, you know, skilled workers, I try to give my staff a living wage. In San Diego, it's very hard, not as hard as New York, San Francisco, Chicago, but it's still hard to live. Most cooks don't make a living wage. They live in houses with multiple people or they live in TJ. So having the proximity to the border being so close and what I do and what I specialize in, I think San Diego has such a diverse kind of cultural, I guess, diversity. You can go to Convoy, you have all these different cuisines. You can go to Chula Vista and you have every single region of Mexico. You can go to La Jolla, you can have amazing bakeries, patisseries, And you can go snowboarding, hiking, surfing, all in the same day. Like we have, San Diego is very special in that way, and it's not overcrowded like LA is. You're not in your car for 5 miles for 2 hours. But at the same time, I have this weird dilemma of, because what I specialize in is not valued in this part of, geographically, of the states, because we're so close to the border. So it's my, I have a love-hate.
No, it's an interesting thing that you bring up, and we hear there's some chefs all across the country. Certain cuisines are just expected to be cheaper. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it goes back to what Mai said, yeah. You know.
I mean, I could do this in LA and charge double the price. No one bats an eye.
Crystal, San Diego, what drew you here?
San Diego. I have lived here 2.5 years. Before this, I lived in San Francisco for 5 years. And before that, I lived in LA for 5 years. And before that, I grew up in Napa. So I've had like pretty exciting food upbringing in so many ways. And I see so much opportunity in San Diego, but it's also a very frustrating place because I don't know, I try to break it down in my head because I am new here. And I think that there are more small farms per capita here than anywhere else in the country, but they are not represented in the restaurants. There are such like incredible sources of produce. Even like I'm growing a passion fruit vine over my patio right now. There's like 500 passion fruits on there. Coming from where I come from up north, I'm like, these cost $5 a piece and they don't taste good. But here it's like this amazing subtropical growing region. Everything grows, everything's amazing, and yet there's just this like lag that's happening. And I think it's just, I don't know what it is, to be honest. There's a lot of restaurant groups, there's a lot of like structured corporate food scene here. I found it very, very difficult to open a small business here because there's like so, nobody's willing to take a chance on somebody who's like trying something small that hasn't owned a restaurant before. Like there's so many hurdles that you jump that I talk to people who've opened restaurants in bigger cities that have a stronger food scene, and they don't, like, it's not easy there by any means, but they don't run into those same hurdles. So I feel like there's this growing excitement about food here that started long ago and has been picking up momentum. And I think that there's so much potential and so much opportunity, but I think there's still so far to go, and I don't know why. I don't know what the hang-up is. I don't know when things are going to start moving forward again. I think there's, like I said, there's so things are going forward significantly, even in the 2.5 years that I've been here. But it's not LA and it's not San Francisco, but it has all the same, I don't know, benchmarks to be met. I don't know.
Mai, how strong is the food community here?
So I grew up in City Heights, which is a largely refugee immigrant population. And what I really love about San Diego and City Heights in particular is that you can just walk along the street and see a lot of independent immigrant-owned businesses. You walk by all these houses and you can kind of see, like, you can tell who lives there, where it's like, okay, there's dragon fruit peeking from that yard, that's a Vietnamese house, there's sugarcane that's flagging a Somali house, and then like Nopal farm like in the city that's like the Mexican house. And so I really love that the food traditions are in people's backyards, and that as you walk through the city and you talk to elders and aunties, you can learn how to harvest and prepare all these different foods from around the world. And it's such a unique sort of microcosm of the world right here. And at the same time, I also you know, the irony isn't beyond me that this is also a military town and that the training up and deployment of troops from here is also related to the diversity of people who have ended up here. But given our circumstances, I really do enjoy meeting, you know, all the neighbors and learning all the different horticultural practices from around the world.
All right, we're going to switch to a little speed round, speed-ish, and then we'll take some questions from the audience. Okay, Claudette, favorite thing to make, bake, or cook?
Pineapple upside down cake.
Ooh.
Yep. Bread. Always.
Oh, naturally fermented, organically grown flour bread that is just so compelling because you have so much less control over it than you want to.
My favorite thing to make, bake, or cook?
Dumplings, because they're a gift for future me.
And to follow up, what kind of dumplings?
Kimchi dumplings.
Ooh. All right. Who is your culinary hero?
Actually, I'm going to piggyback off of Julia Child. I learned English watching Julia Child. Wow. Mr. Bean, Are You Being Served? The BBC taught me English, my brothers. So Julia Child is my culinary hero.
I mean, it's like a three-way tie. Chad Robertson is definitely one of them. Alice Waters is a huge one. And Nancy Silverton is ever popular in this community.
We love Nancy. Mm-hmm. Mai, your culinary hero?
Min Fan, who's over there by the cocktail bar. She's the like creative genius behind Porridge and Puffs, which is a restaurant up in LA, award-winning, and also made time to come down here on her one day off a week to hold this baby while I give this talk. So, yeah.
It takes a village. So thank you for being here. We can't wait to come see your place in LA. All right, where do you do your best thinking since this is the Food for Thought tour?
Lately, the dish pit.
While I'm shaping bread, and nobody's bothering me.
it all goes back to bread for you.
It really is a quintessential part of my life.
Probably in bed right before I fall asleep.
This might be a tough one, but your favorite thing, a favorite thing to eat or drink in San Diego that you do not make?
There's this really small Indian Punjabi restaurant in Miramar that is a hole in the wall, and the cashier daughter is always pissed off, and I'm a glutton for punishment, and so I go there, and she hates me. My favorite place.
What do you get there?
One of everything. They have, like, the lunch special where you can get the tikka masala, the rice, the samosas. I just go, yes, one of everything, and she looks at me, rolls her eyes, and then gets it for me.
And you cannot say bread by someone else.
Okay.
There's this adorable cafe out in Ocean Beach called Little Lion Cafe, and it's owned by two sisters, and they're fantastic, and they make this, like, mermaid bowl that is just so good. It's like chia seeds and algae and coconut cream and fresh fruit, and you're right outside, like, looking at the ocean, and it's just, like, a dream.
I'm a sucker for anything called mermaid.
I really like the lemonade berries that ripen on the trails around here. So when you're like on Mission Trails or if you're in like Black Mountain or Torrey Pines, in the spring, the lemonade berries come out. And it's these berries that essentially it's the semen berry that tastes like lemonade. And always very odd for runners going by because, like, I don't want to pick the berries off because you want to retain the berries so they can propagate. So I'm just, like, sucking on these berries off of the plant. But they're really delicious. I highly recommend them.
You are amazing. What do they look like?
It's a kind of sumac, and then the fruit is they're, like, cranberry-sized and red, and they have like a white coating when they're ready. Yeah, they're at perfect mouth height.
I don't think we have those in Brooklyn, but I could be wrong. Well, that is it. We want to take some questions from, we have one already.
I just want to know, what are you excited about food right now, whether that be a food movement or a certain seasonal produce or the pint of Ben and Jerry's in your fridge that you're going to have tonight?
Yeah, the amount of ice cream. I'm a huge ice cream lover. I'm excited that people are, at least in our community, we're going back to cooking what is comforting versus what is hip. I try to teach my cooks, like, think of what you ate and what resonated with you when you were a child and make that feeling again on a plate. And I feel like more and more of our community and my friends and my colleagues are all talking about just kind of going backwards, like simplifying, editing, and cooking what makes you feel good and what you're proud to serve. So it doesn't have to be always aesthetically pleasing as long as it tastes good. So I think going backwards to what we... like the comfort, like the world's going, but our food is good. You know, it's like, that's like the one place where you're like, yes, a warm bowl of soup. Like, soup is good.
Hi, I'm Dawn.
Hi, Crystal.
My question is for all of you in terms of what stories do you want to see more in the media?
I feel like media still has kind of like the media darlings of the industry, and I would like to see more in smaller towns. You know, what you see in the media, it's what's New York, San Francisco, LA, Chicago. We're a flyover city. San Diego doesn't exist in the media world. We really don't. Like, we get a little bit, and then it's like, oh yeah, but LA. You know, like, yeah, San Diego's small, but we're huge. You know, we're a huge county, and we have a lot of talented chefs. There's my great friends, amazing, talented chefs in Indianapolis. They'll never get anything because they're next to Chicago, you know? It's like, so I would like to, and it's really on us and on the journalists to kind of go out there and find it. You know, like, that's how it's easy to write a piece on Alvueda. It's easy to write a piece on Javier Plasencia and Baja. But how about you write the next generation? You know, like, find the people that were maybe started with them and that spawned off in their own project. You know, one of my best friends owns Emilia in Mexico City, one of the best restaurants I've ever been to in recent memory. No one knows about it. And it was just like a breathtaking experience going, damn, this place is amazing. The music, the vibe. It's always packed because it's a 20-seat restaurant, but you don't hear anything about it on media because it's just not, the name, the tag name, you know? So just more diversity.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say this for this podcast, but I'm very proud to be a woman-owned business, but I would like it if it would stop being referred to as that necessarily.
I think maybe less so about the stories that are told, but what happens after the story is told is what I'm interested in. Like, I'm often asked to speak at conferences or do like talks with socially conscious media, and you know they're like, okay, tell us your sad minority story. I'm like, okay, well, but like, what are you going to do to help me get to the point where we can all be equal, right? What sort of work in terms of equity are you going to do to help connect me with investors who would look at me and doubt my ability to farm? So I think having media take that other step of having accountability and working with the people whose stories they're telling to succeed so that there's a story down the line of, you know, where we've been and how far we've come. I think that's what I'd like to see more of.
We totally agree, Mai. I was very happy to learn that after we left San Diego, some of the attendees started the San Diego Women in Food Networking Group. If you live in the area and would like to know more, check out Medi Chefs on Instagram. That's MediChefs, Medi Chefs. Thank you to our speakers and our attendees for such a lovely event. And a big thank you to Kerrygold for supporting our tour and providing us with beautiful butter and cheese at each stop. Our show is produced and edited by Jess Seidman. Thanks for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.